Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you to the ISO 9001 2015, Knowing What to Expect to Ensure a Stress-Free Audit webinar. My name is Joseph Kroldikowski. I am the QMS Program Manager for Perry Johnson Registrars. Now, our topics for today, I've got some preliminary discussion on what ISO 9001 is and understanding it and kind of getting your arms around its intent. From there, I've got a disclaimer for you. And then the heart of this presentation is walking through some key areas: management review, internal auditing, quality objectives, monitoring, measuring resources, and external provider approvals. I've got separate commentary on each of those items. We'll wrap up with some discussion on risk and the concept of interested parties and the role of leadership, and then we will address your questions. Now, anybody that is working with ISO 9001:2015, one of the things that you have to understand about ISO 9001:2015 to really be able to work with it effectively is that it is an interpretive document. It's meant to be interpreted. And it's interesting, when ISO 9001 was first published, the 2015 revision, it was actually the first version of ISO 9001 to have a built-in explanatory appendix, Appendix A. It has since become one of the only ISO published standards to have a separate supplemental standard specifically for explanatory purposes. So let's discuss what that is. That explanatory standard is called TS 9002. Now, TS stands for Technical Specification. This item was published about a little over a year after ISO 9001:2015. We'll be referring to this document here and there in our presentation today, simply as ISO 9002. Now, ISO 9002's full title is Quality Management Systems, Guidelines for the Application of ISO 9001:2015. Now, what this is, it is an officially sanctioned guidance document, and it provides clause-by-clause ideas on fulfilling all of the various requirements from ISO 9001. It actually follows the same numbering scheme and clausal structure so that you can do some comparison kind of point for point on what ISO 9001 tells you, which is of course enforceable in the context of an audit, and then what 9002 is telling you. Now, 9002 is not a certifiable document. You cannot get ISO 9002 certified, but it is very much a helpful document. It's a guidance document. If we've got anybody on our call today that remembers the original version of ISO 9004, ISO 9002 is similarly written. It is, again, a clause-by-clause explanatory document. So we've kind of beat this point to death that ISO 9001 is interpretive. So what does that mean? Well, in rather plain English, it's meant to be interpreted. And by way of extension, that means that none of these requirements has a perfect method for implementation. It's up to each individual organization to figure out for themselves what it means to fulfill these various requirements. And the auditor's role then is to review what the organization has implemented and exercise their judgment on whether or not what the organization has done is a true fulfillment of the requirement. Now, one thing I always like to point out about ISO 9001 is the fact that it has, in the 2015 revision, it has completely eliminated procedural requirements. Now, if you go back to the first and second editions of ISO 9001, there were actually 16 required procedures at that time for a wide variety of things. When the 2000 and 2008 versions, the third and fourth editions, were published, that was trimmed to 6 required procedures. Now, with the 2015 revision, there are no required procedures. So the organization is allowed to kind of decide for itself what it means to have control over its activities. Now, a lot of organizations still have procedures. They have them for a variety of things. And obviously, that's fine. But if you choose to have a procedure, you need to understand that the content of that procedure can still be looked at and potentially cited in the context of an audit. And that's due to how the term audit criteria is defined. This is a kind of a critical definition that appears in the ISO 9000 guidance document. Audit criteria is defined as a set of policies, procedures, or requirements that are used as reference against which objective evidence is compared. So in other words, when we audit you for ISO 9001, it's not exclusively ISO 9001 that we're holding you accountable to. It's all of the various criteria. So your own procedures, your own work instructions, the requirements from your customers or from other interested parties, and so forth. These can all be brought to bear in the context of an ISO 9001 audit. Now, ISO 9001:2015 has been in print. This is rather unbelievable. 7 years this standard has been out. And ISO 9001 itself is over 30 years old at this point. It's actually closing in on 35 years that it's been around. But in spite of the fact that it's been around for that amount of time, the same things seem to come up over and over again in ISO 9001 audits. So somehow the word doesn't get out that these are the things we're looking for. So when this presentation was originally put together, I conducted a data mining exercise. I pulled approximately 350 audits looking at a 12-month slice of time. And I did this across multiple territories even. This included not just the United States, but clients in Japan, Thailand, et cetera. And the analysis revealed that in terms of nonconformances that are being written, you can point to 5 core areas where they come up the most often. And these are ordered by frequency of issuance. And in the last 4 years since this data mining exercise was performed, we've done, I should say, I've done some sporadic rechecking on this. And this ranking, for the most part, is holding strong. This is still where the issues are being cited. So we're going to go through all 5 of these now. But I want to point out, it's interesting to note, that 3 of these, management review, internal audit, and calibration, these are all legacy items. These are items that have been part of the ISO 9001 standard going all the way back to version 1 that was published back in 1987. So none of this is new. None of this is new ideas. These are all existing requirements that go back many years. So obviously, we cannot advocate specific methodologies for implementing a requirement. What we can do, though, in our position as a certification body is we can try to provide some clarity on what these requirements are commonly interpreted to mean and how they are commonly fulfilled. So what we're going to be looking at over the next several slides here, this is not an official endorsement of approach. And obviously it can't be used as justification for any circumstance cited by an auditor to dispute. We will be giving some clarification on filing a dispute a little bit later in the presentation. But basically, we want to try to share what we've learned over the years in terms of how these should be approached and what they mean. So here we go. So let's start at the top. The number one most cited item is management review. Now, management review in ISO 9001:2015 is found in section 9.3. And 9.3 actually has three subclauses, what we're going to refer to here today as parts. So let's start with part one. Now, the key portion in part one, I've got it underlined here, is that management review needs to be done at planned intervals. It intends that you have some manner of controlling the frequency and the content of the management review meetings. Now, as to what that is going to be, what those controls are going to be, well, that's up to you. You know, you may have schedules, you may have procedural stipulations, you may have automated reminders, but you need to have something that demonstrates that you have implemented this idea of planned intervals. That's what's expected here. Now, in the second part of the management review requirement, we have a long list of required discussion topics. And each of these, frankly, is of equal weight. There's a number of items here that are obvious. You know, you should be talking about customer satisfaction. You should be talking about audit results. You should be talking about corrective action activity, resource effectiveness, and so forth. So the intent here, I'm going to go ahead and jump forward a slide. These items are mandatory. These discussion points are mandatory. But importantly, it is not mandatory that you hit these items at every single management review. So in other words, if you wanted to take the management review process and kind of eat the elephant in small bites, do a little bit at a time, that's great. Go for it. That's fine. But recognize that each of those items on that second part of the requirement, you do have to eventually discuss each of those items. Now, we have a number of clients that use PowerPoint presentations or some other presentation medium to organize their management review activity. That's fine. You can do that, but it's not mandatory. A lot of organizations like to use standardized agenda formats to make sure that nothing is missed. That's also great, and it's also not mandatory. Again, what you want to think of is what's going to work for you to make sure you hit all the required discussion points. Now, the third and final part of the management review requirement says that the outputs of the management review need to include decisions and actions. And that's a real critical part of this. And I'd like to point this out, this idea that the management review is supposed to be productive. You know, it is not intended to just be, okay, let's talk about these points and move on. The management review is supposed to include decisions and actions. Now, the last critical item that I want to point out here is this business of retained documented information in that final paragraph here. The management review activity is supposed to be on the record. You're supposed to have documented records of when the meeting was held, what was discussed, what was decided, and so forth. Okay, the second most often cited item in the ISO 9001 audits is the internal audit requirement. Now, internal audit requirements are found right next door to management review in section 9.2. And this requirement is found in two subclauses. So in part one, again, we've got a couple of key items here. Again, we have planned intervals for internal audits. And I want you to note the verbiage on quality management system. Internal audits providing information on the quality management system, hold that thought. And ensuring also that the requirements of this international standard is effectively implemented and maintained. Okay, so let's jump ahead here and kind of pick this apart. Again, with planned intervals, this means that your internal audits are supposed to be conducted according to some sort of scheduling mechanism. Now, again, what form and shape that takes, that is entirely up to you. If it is a formal schedule, if it's something written into a procedure, if it's a series of audit plans, whatever the case may be, it's up to you. But you need to have something to demonstrate that the audits are done at planned intervals. Again, just like with the management review, you're absolutely allowed to conduct the internal audit in smaller bites. If you want to do it all at once, that's fine. If you want to do it a little at a time, that's also fine. Now, I also like to point out, like I did earlier, this business of the requirements of this international standard. You have to make sure that you are enforcing all of the requirements from ISO 9001:2015. And that includes the internal audit process itself. This is an area that companies, especially newer companies, tend to get tripped up on. You did an internal audit of everything else, but you didn't audit the audit. I know that sounds silly, but that is required. You have to have some sort of internal audit on the internal audit process itself. So do bear that in mind. Now, this business of the audit is to be performed against the quality management system. Let's dissect that statement a little bit. Remember that ISO 9001 in section 4.4 states that a quality management system is made up of processes. Here's the exact verbiage. The organization shall determine the processes needed for the quality management system and their application throughout the organization. So the expectation then is that when you conduct your internal audits, you are using a process approach and not just the clauses of ISO 9001:2015 itself. You know, everything else in ISO 9001 is process oriented, and the internal audit activity is no different in that regard. So again, these need to be process-based internal audits. Now, moving on to the second part of the internal audit requirement, I've got some items highlighted here. You need to select auditors and conduct audits in a manner that ensures objectivity and impartiality. You need to take correction and corrective action on issues that are raised. And again, we have a retained documented information statement. So let's pick these apart just a bit. You know, we talk about selection of internal auditors. This is something I think I get asked about this at least once a month. I'll have a client that'll call in and will ask me, do I have to send my internal auditors to internal auditor school? And the short answer is no, you don't. You have to recognize that internal auditing is one more competency within your organization. And right now our salespeople are screaming at me, how dare you? But but you have to bear in mind that this is your internal audit, this is your process. So you have your own way of determining what it means to have the internal auditor be competent. So if that means to you sending them to internal auditor training, well, great. That's fine. But there's other ways to meet the requirement. And you have to decide for yourself what that means. So you need to be able to demonstrate that whatever you chose is effective, obviously. We're going to be looking very carefully at your internal audit to make sure that it was carried out in an effective manner. But as far as the means and methods, that's definitely up to you. Now, an issue that does come up frequently, especially, again, for newer clients, is a lack of responsiveness to internal audit nonconformances. Now, we see this especially if an organization is kind of in a rush to get through their certification. They get the internal audit done, and they have the certification assessment a week or two later, and then they're wondering, why are we asking about the internal audit nonconformances? Well, you're required to close those out. You're required to treat those with the same seriousness that you would a PJR nonconformance or even a customer complaint. And as I pointed out, the standard tells you that this should include correction and corrective action. Finally, it is another area, internal auditing is another area where records are required. And there's a lot of ways that you can climb this mountain, so to speak. Checklists, procedural printouts, internal audit databases. Whatever you choose to use is at your discretion, but understand that it needs to be sufficiently detailed to give us confidence that you audited your entire quality management system. And bear in mind, this should not just be a pile of nonconformances. We should be able to verify definitively that you audited the entire quality management system, all of your processes and activities. Now, I want to make a key point on consultants. A lot of our clients, probably several of you on our call today, choose to outsource your internal audit program to a consultant, and that is completely fine. But please remember that regardless of who performs the audit, the responsibility for the internal audit program, scheduling of the audit, the maintenance of the records, responding to nonconformances, et cetera, that's your job, not your consultant's job. So you need to be prepared to speak confidently about your internal audit process and how you control it. When we ask about the internal audits, if you're inclined to say, well, our consultant handles all that, wrong answer. This is still your program and you are responsible for it. Okay, let's continue with quality objectives, the third most often cited item. Again, this one is split into two subclauses. To begin with, it is required that your quality objectives be measurable, that your quality objectives be relevant to the conformity of your products and services, that they contribute to customer satisfaction, and that they be monitored, communicated, and updated. So let's pick these items apart. First of all, the quality objectives need to be measurable. And without measurability, there's really no way to determine if you met the objective or not. Now, the preferred fulfillment of this item is to have what we call variable type objectives. In other words, something that you can measure, on-time delivery, 90%, 95%, that sort of thing. You can, however, if you choose, you can have what we refer to as attribute type objectives. So what do I mean by attribute objectives? Well, let's say that you want to achieve a NADCAP accreditation, or you want to establish a new building, a new warehouse in Fort Worth, Texas, we'll go with. Well, that's something where either you accomplish it or you don't. So that can be thought of as an attribute type objective, kind of a pass-fail type item. Now, in terms of relevancy to customer satisfaction and products and services, this was actually a new idea when ISO 9001 2015 was published. This whole idea that your objectives needed to be relevant to your products and services and customer satisfaction. It's important for us to acknowledge, however, that this does not mean that these are the only types of objectives you can have. You know, there's a lot of organizations out there that feel it is value added, that it's beneficial to have objectives for things like profitability or workplace safety or things of this nature that aren't quite tied in with products or customer satisfaction. These types of objectives are fine, absolutely fine to have those as your objectives. The only thing you need to bear in mind, though, is that it cannot solely be those types of items. You do have to have some form of objectives that reflects on the conformity of your products and services and contributes to customer satisfaction. Furthermore, quality objectives are an item that everybody in your organization needs to be prepared to speak about with some demonstrated knowledge and awareness. Now, they don't need to have them memorized, that's not the point, but they do need to recognize what the auditor is talking about when the topic comes up. And there's a lot of ways that you can accomplish this. You know, some organizations, they'll have placards throughout the facility, they'll have awareness meetings, etc. Again, none of this is mandatory. It all kind of dials back to, is what you're doing effective? Now, the second part of the quality objectives requirement states that you need to determine what is going to be done with your objectives and how you're going to align resources, who's going to be responsible, and so forth. Taking that statement, what will be done? We can look to ISO 9002 for some clarity on what they mean by that. And in 9002, it states that you need to determine the actions that need to be implemented to achieve the quality objectives. So the big idea here, of course, is it's not enough to simply have the objectives. If you're not achieving your objectives, you need to take some action in response to that. So again, the big picture is you need to take necessary action. And this means an appropriate response. It may not necessarily mean formal corrective action, but it means some form of response, whatever that may be. Now, our fourth most often cited item is monitoring and measuring resources. Now, for a number of you on our call today, I suspect you refer to this requirement as calibration. That's kind of the common term that's used for this. So monitoring and measuring resources, this is any device, tool, gauge, meter, scale, et cetera, that's used to perform monitoring and measurement of outputs. Now, this is most typically going to be referred to as inspection or testing. And our primary clause for this is in section 7.1.5. And again, there are two subclauses. Now, in the first part here, there's some kind of overview statements. You need to determine what resources are needed. You need to make sure that the resources are suitable. And then in that third paragraph, you need to retain appropriate documented information as evidence of fitness for purpose of your monitoring and measurement resources. So let's put this kind of in plain English here. What this means in terms of fitness for purpose, fitness for use, this is going to manifest in the calibration or verification records that you keep for your measurement devices. Basically, if you have a measurement device that you are using for product inspection, and it is used for anything that isn't an imprecise or reference measurement, you need to have evidence, documented evidence, that it's been verified, that it's been found to be fit for purpose. Now, in terms of what those records need to include, this is where we turn to the second part of the requirement. So here's that second part. And as you can see, there's a lot here, but there's a couple of key points that seem to come up most often in the audit process. So once you've concluded that the measuring equipment is necessary, that it's going to be necessary to provide confidence in measurement results, that measuring equipment needs to be calibrated or verified. Those are two separate things. At specified intervals, here's the key part, against measurement standards traceable to international or national measurement standards. Second key part, they shall be identified in order to determine status. Those are the two real key pieces here and the items that seem to come up the most often in the audit process. So let's talk first about national or international standards. Now, here in the United States, we have the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, and their function, kind of an interesting operation. Their function is to establish master standards for the measurements, all the different measurements that are possible. So length and weight and volume and anything else you can think of, elasticity, etc. And they issue these national standards and verify these national standards, and it kind of spreads out by a series of master laboratories and sub-laboratories and so forth. So what we're looking for when we look over your calibration records, we're looking for that NIST code. We're looking for that NIST code. Okay, is the calibration that was done for this device, is it traceable to a NIST reference number? Now, where it is not possible to certify an item back to NIST, now this is exceedingly rare, but it does happen. It is considered acceptable for calibration to be performed by the device manufacturer. There's very few instances of that anymore, but they do happen still from time to time. Now, the other point that I had underlined was this business about identification in order to determine status. Now, this is another item that seems to be misinterpreted from time to time. And the unfortunate conclusion that some folks have reached, including auditors in some cases, is that this means calibration stickers. It doesn't. What it means is that the measurement devices need to be traceable to the calibration records. There's a lot of ways you can do that. Device numbers, serial numbers, etc. Something that gets you back to the calibration records. So identified in order to determine status. Not necessarily identified showing status. Okay, the fifth item on our list is external provider approvals. Now, in the older versions of ISO 9001, these groups were referred to as suppliers or subcontractors or outside partners, these sorts of things. They were all kind of brought together under this collective term external provider in the 2015 version. But the requirements here are not new. And they come primarily in section 8.4.1. So what does it say? Well, it says that you need to determine criteria for the evaluation, selection, monitoring of performance, and reevaluation of your external providers, and that you need to retain documented information of these activities, plural. Bear that in mind. We're going to hit on that in a second here. So first of all, you have to establish a methodology for external provider approval. Now, what that is, and whether there are alternatives, that's at your discretion. You'll also note that the requirement calls for monitoring and reevaluation also. And so, I mean, what form that takes, again, that's up to you. Now, you'll note also that it says retain documented information, records, needs to be maintained of the evaluation activities. Now, what that means is having the external provider's name on a list, that's not evidence of evaluation. Doesn't tell me anything about how you performed the evaluation activity. So it tells me they were evaluated, but not what the evaluation activity was. And that's another item that comes up from time to time in the nonconformances that are written. Now, moving past the most common issued nonconformances, I want to talk a little bit about two additional key areas that were new when ISO 9001:2015 was first published, and that's risk and interested parties. Let's start with risk. Now, the term risk is actually used 16 times in the auditable portion of ISO 9001:2015. And the intent with this requirement is it is a system-wide strategy, very much in the same spirit that continual improvement was when the third edition of ISO 9001 was published. And one of the things that is emphasized is you don't have to have a formal risk management process. The idea is that risk aversion is something that's going to impact all the various areas of your quality management system. 9002 provides a little bit of guidance here in saying that the failure of your processes, products, and services to meet requirements or not achieving customer satisfaction, those are key risks. Those are the key risks that your system should focus on. Now, the risk requirement is housed primarily in Section 6.1. And in the first part, it basically says that when you're planning for your system, you need to consider the issues from 4.1. That means those that come both from inside and outside the organization, and the requirements referred to in 4.2. And that means both the ones coming from internal and external interested parties. And from that analysis, you need to determine risks and opportunities that need to be addressed. And the fact that both terms are discussed is key here. This is not exclusively things that can go wrong, you know, undesired effects, like it talks about under subclause C here. Could also be good things, could be enhancing desirable effects. That's why the terms risks and opportunities are, they are used side by side in this requirement. And obviously the big picture here is assurance that your system can achieve its intended results and can also achieve improvement. In 6.1.2, it states that you need to plan your actions on addressing risks and opportunities and how you're going to integrate and implement those actions into your processes and therefore evaluate the effectiveness of those actions. So what do they mean by actions to address risks and opportunities? So again, we turn to 9002 for some guidance in this area. And 9002 breaks it down into five pieces. It says, first of all, you can avoid the risk. You can stop doing the process in question, if that's an option. You can limit the risk. You can have things like procedures or work instructions to assist the personnel and reduce the risk in that manner. You can share the risk. An example of this might be working with your customers on agreeing to bulk buying of raw materials. You can transfer the risk. This can be things like insurance or other types of arrangements. And then finally, risk acceptance. When you've deployed all the other reasonable measures, you accept whatever residual risk is remaining and declare it as acceptable. So in terms of how we audit this area, we've trained our auditors to basically take an open-minded approach when they assess this area. We tell our auditors, okay, ask the question, what have you done to implement this requirement? Now, the expectation, obviously, is that you understand this requirement and you can explain what your approach has been. Now, it's important to point out that there's really only one requirement as far as documentation of risk actions, and it's found in Section 9.3 under Management Review. Now, Management Review inputs include 9.3.2e, effectiveness of actions taken to address risks and opportunities. This needs to be discussed within the Management Review process. Now, obviously, Management Review is required to be on the record. So this is the one area we can point to and say, okay, show me the evidence that you discussed risk actions within your Management Review process. Turning our attention then to interested parties. Another interesting idea, a new idea at the time, interested parties is actually defined right in the 9001 standard itself. And it's defined as a person or organization that can affect, be affected by, or perceive themselves to be affected by a decision or activity. And there's a lot of examples that are given right in the standard. Customers, employees of the organization, suppliers, bankers, etc. Now in clause 4.2, there's some clarification given on this. It says that you need to determine who your interested parties are, but it goes on to say you need to determine the interested parties that are relevant to your quality management system. So, you know, obviously you could probably talk yourself into lots of different folks being an interested party by definition, but the key here is, do these interested parties have relevancy to your quality management system? This is intended to be a very broad idea. It's intended to get you thinking about where requirements are going to be coming from. Now, one thing that we've tried to emphasize both to our auditors and to our clients is that it is most likely inappropriate for an organization to conclude that their only interested party group is their customer base. Now, if an organization tells us just our customers, that's the only interested party, we are going to expect that organization to explain the process that they used to reach that conclusion. How did you perform the analysis and draw that conclusion? Now, if they can't show us that it was analyzed in any particular way, potentially the process by which the interested parties were selected was flawed, and that organization may receive a nonconformance. Not definitely, but may. Now, 9002 gives a really good comprehensive list of who the possible interested parties might be, even longer than what appears in the 9001 guidance. Things like local community groups, statutory regulatory authorities, shareholders, franchisers, joint venture partners, end users, and so forth. Now, in terms of figuring out who your interested parties are, again, ISO 9002 offers some helpful guidance. And if you read through this list, these are all things that most companies do anyhow. Most companies review the orders they receive from their customers. Most companies engage in some form of lobbying and networking. Most companies participate in their local associations. Most companies are monitoring customer needs and so forth. There's a lot of ways that you can identify what are the needs of the interested parties and then respond to those needs. Now, there are possible nonconformances in an ISO 9001 audit related to interested parties. First of all, if there is no evidence or limited evidence that you're monitoring or reviewing information from interested parties, you could potentially be cited under Section 4.2. And also, if there's no evidence that interested party feedback is being discussed within management review, that falls under 9.3.2C1. Now, there's one more thing I'd like to discuss from ISO 9001, and that is the concept of leadership. And leadership, this idea of leadership, is found primarily in Section 5.1. So what we've done with this concept, this is a very broad idea. We have written a series of targeted questions for our auditors to ask the management team under the heading of the leadership interview. We've done this because we want to make sure that leadership is aware of what's going on in the system and that they are directly involved in the management of the system. So let's dig into what's asked. What are you doing to make yourself accountable for the effectiveness of your system? How do you participate in your system? Who are your interested parties? What are some issues that are going on, both internal and external? These questions are asked right during the context of the audit itself. Now, a key thing about leadership, understand that leadership is supposed to mean leadership as in the leadership team. Once in a great while, we will note an audit is turned in and there's only one person that was interviewed for the leadership interview. That's conceivable in a small company, but it becomes a lot less plausible in any company of a larger headcount, particularly anything in excess of, say, 10 people. It's really hard to accept that there's one person that represents the leadership for that organization. So bear that in mind. That's why your auditor is asking, okay, let's get the team together, the leadership team. Now, ISO 9002 provides some clarification on the role of top management. It states that certain authorities and responsibilities can be delegated, but the idea is that accountability remains with top management. So in other words, you can still have a management representative, absolutely, but you cannot say, okay, my management rep is handling that. You're the president, you're the vice president, you're the CEO, et cetera. This is still your quality management system. You can't excuse yourself and say, well, my management rep handles that. That may have been acceptable in years past. It is not acceptable anymore. Now, we've gone over a lot of concepts today, a lot of items. We've talked here and there about what might be cited as a nonconformance, etc. We do occasionally get asked about what happens if we don't agree on a nonconformance that's been issued. And we ask our clients, first of all, work with your auditor if there's a point of disagreement. You know, sometimes the auditor needs to see additional evidence. Sometimes their understanding of what they're looking at may not be optimal. But if you've talked the item through and the auditor has concluded this is a nonconformance, this is where you would want to request to file the dispute. And we have a procedure for that. It is our Pro 10 procedure. And Pro 10 is available for download right on our webpage. If you go to the pjr.com, bottom of the page, look for registration document download. Now, if you're going to file a dispute, you are required to do so within 15 days of the end of the audit. So do bear that in mind. Now, 9001:2015 is the world's most utilized standard. There are just over 900,000 registered companies worldwide. A lot of the things that get cited in the audits are entirely avoidable, and they seem to come up time and time again. So it's our hope that the content of this presentation is going to leave you feeling more confident that things will go well on audit day. If you're ready for a deeper dive, if you'd like to learn a little more about ISO 9001, we do offer a clause-by-clause primer course. We literally talk you through the standard front to back. If you're interested in this course, it is 100% free. Just go to pgr.com and look for the link under the training tab. You can sign up and take the course today. I'd like to invite you to tune in for one of our other webinars. I have a special presentation on exemptions and non-applicable clauses. This is a deep dive into what you can and cannot claim as an exemption from your quality management system. I've got another presentation on the interaction of processes and how this is so important to a successful audit. And we have presentations on a whole wide variety of things, corrective action, stage one auditing, and many of the other standards that we certify to. So check it out. If you'd like to be kept informed of the latest news automatically, the best way for you to do that is to visit our website at www.pgr.com. Go to the bottom of the page, enter your email address, and click subscribe. You will be opted in for automatic updates on changes to the standards, upcoming webinars, and other points of information. That's it for my presentation. I'm going to go ahead and unlock the question portion of the dashboard. As a reminder, if you're looking to have a copy of the slides, they will be available for download shortly after we're finished. And if you'd like to rewatch this webinar with the voiceover, it will be posted on our YouTube page in a short time as well. So it'll be there for you if you want to watch it again. Any other questions that I can answer today? Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. Hope this was helpful. Have a great day.